I'm John Banther, and this is Classical Breakdown. From WETA Classical in Washington, we are your guide to classical music. In this episode, I'm joined by Charles Lawson, one of our fantastic recording engineers at WETA Classical, who spends most of his time recording the National Symphony Orchestra at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. But just what does a classical music recording engineer do, and what makes a good or great recording? It is way more involved and complicated than you thought. Charles shows us what it's like to record one of our country's great orchestras every week. He talks about how recordings are made and edited, things that annoy engineers and how to avoid them. Plus, we hear a little bit of a recording he made of the NSO that is out of this world. Before we get started, I wanted to mention something that I've actually not even heard you say to me ever at all. I just found this out by just, Googling you, and that is that you apparently made a disc that was then put on the Orion capsule, you know, NASA space stuff, and then sent off to space. And I've never heard you talk about that. I find that very intriguing.
Yes, that's a fun story, actually. We got a request from NASA, I presume, to record a segment of The Planets, a little bit of Mars from The Planets by Gustav Holst. And I was asked if I could record that with the orchestra, make sure it was no longer than 3 minutes, that is the music part of it, and then make a CD that they could launch on board the spacecraft. Well, sure, I'm an old-time space nerd. I just love the idea, so of course I can do that. So Ankush Kumar Bahel, who was the associate conductor of the orchestra at the time, led the performance. The orchestra played it beautifully, and I took it away and mastered a CD, and we sent that to NASA, and it flew on the spacecraft. And it's my understanding that it's on display somewhere, either at NASA headquarters or in some museum somewhere, but I have been told that there is a place that you can actually see this disc. And it was a tremendous thrill for me, because anything I could do affiliated with NASA is just a dream come true for me. I grew up at a time when NASA was the thing. Space exploration was still relatively new and exciting. So yeah, this was a tremendous thrill for me.
That's extraordinary, because I think of Dvorak 9, it was taken upon one of the Apollo spacecraft as well. I think actually when they went to the moon even. And so just now, you know, a recording of Mars has now been floating around for some time around the Earth and yes, now on display. That's just amazing.
Yeah, I wish I could say it's still out there, maybe on its way to a distant star like the Voyager record, but no, I think it was an orbital mission and they brought it back, and that's how you can see it on display here on Earth now. I really loved that project, and it was tremendous fun.
So let's just jump into this then and talk about your life as a classical music engineer. Say we just met and we talked for a few minutes, and then we do the thing where we tell each other what we do. How would you describe that to me if I didn't even know?
Well, essentially what I do is I'm in charge of recording the performances of the National Symphony Orchestra. That is, I choose the microphones to be used, I place them, I do the actual recording, the sound mix of everything that has been recorded, and then edit together a composite performance that we use for an NSO showcase. And occasionally, one of those recordings will find its way to a commercial release as well, but principally it's for broadcast. In previous generations, some decades ago, there was sort of a company of people who would do this sort of thing. You would have the engineer, the actual engineer, who would often build the equipment that they used, but if not build it, would select premium equipment to be used for the process and then maybe modify it to make it even better. And then there would be a producer who would work closely with the musicians to try to determine what the repertoire was going to be, how to best represent it in a recording, and work with the engineers to determine where the microphone should be placed to get the kind of picture that the artist, either a soloist or a conductor, would like to convey to an end listener. And then during the sessions, would actually kind of manage the sessions, would be listening through, following the score, noting if there was anything that might need to be patched later on, and communicate these things to the ensemble, and be able to re-record and make sure that those things are covered later. And then there would be somebody who would edit the material together. And then there would be somebody who would take the edited material and then refine it a little bit more so that they would make a master out of it. And then if it were going to LP, there would be somebody else involved. So it was a pretty big industry back a few decades ago. Nowadays, because of technological improvements and mostly because of budgetary constraints, often you have one person or maybe two at most doing the whole thing. So what I do is first the engineering part, which includes making sure that we have the right equipment for the job, that it's functioning, that if there are modifications required, that those are done, whatever they may be. And then I have to put on my producer hat to talk to the conductor to say, is there something special about this piece that I need to be worried about or that you absolutely want to make sure it gets captured and conveyed? And if so, I'll have to make the decision about, all right, what change of microphone placement might we require in order to accommodate that? And then once the recordings are over, I need to assemble the best possible representation for broadcast or sometimes commercial release. So there are a number of steps, and I wind up being the person who does most of that these days, mostly, as I say, because the equipment makes it easier for one person to wrangle everything, and the budgets have shrunk such that having an entire team do it on a regular basis tends to be cost prohibitive. So I'm the best compromise there is, I guess.
I will say, when I see you working, you're usually quite busy. So most of the time, I think your job has you here at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, recording the National Symphony Orchestra. So walk us through a week of what that's like. You've mentioned a little bit talking with a conductor, but looking at, like, what does that look like? Like Monday morning, everyone's favorite day. Everyone gets up. What are you doing?
Monday morning is usually my day off because the orchestra has the day off.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, I don't often get the day off. You know, I may get some hours off, but I'm usually thinking about what's going to be happening during the course of the next week, because Tuesday is when the orchestra starts to have their first rehearsals, and that's often the day that we actually hang my microphones. Prior to that, usually the week prior, or farther ahead than that, depending on what the repertoire is, I will examine the repertoire and see what's on the program. Mm. Typically, if it's repertoire I understand and have recorded before even, I'll know how to proceed, and it'll be a very straightforward week. If there's something I'm not familiar with, the first thing I'll do is look around and say, well, has anybody else performed it? And if so, where? And is there a video available so I can see what might be required? And if there's no video, is there at least an audio recording that I can sample to find out what the texture is going to be like? You know, what's the instrumentation? How hard is this going to be to capture? Once those questions are answered, then I will usually be given a stage plot. This is where we plan to put the orchestra, and this is the rehearsal order, so I'll know what needs to be hung by when in order to cover what's going on. And then the first day of rehearsal, we typically hang after the orchestra actually goes through their first pair of rehearsals. We do that for a couple of reasons. Number one, there's not a whole lot of time before they start their first rehearsal for me to get my stuff hung and in place, and there's just too much else going on. They need to worry about the stage setup, so really they want to put me off a little bit. But I sometimes will come in early anyway, so I can sit in the house while that rehearsal is going on, so I can see what the orchestra layout is. I can hear an unfamiliar piece as it's being played in the hall to find out, okay, how does that sound? What are the balance issues in this piece? How am I going to compensate for that? And then after those decisions are kind of arrived at, or at least I have a general idea, I'll go down and talk to John Adrian Nozeda or another conductor, perhaps, to find out after they have done those rehearsals, is this really where the orchestra is going to sit? Because sometimes they change. Mm. And if so, is there anything that I should be especially concerned about? And in some cases, I'll use as an example a work by Alfredo Casella that John Andrea brought to the orchestra. They'd never played it before, I don't believe. And I was unfamiliar with the music. And so after the rehearsal, I went and asked, you know, is there anything in particular that you are concerned about? You know, I'm unfamiliar with the composer. I'm unfamiliar with this piece. Is there something in particular that you want to bring out? And he immediately grabbed the score and flipped through some pages and pointed to some things. He said, I want to make sure that, you know, this line comes out well because, you know, it works with this line. And so, okay, no problem. That would be covered by my usual microphone setup. I'm not worried about that. So then after the orchestra clears the stage, the crew usually comes out and we will begin hanging my stuff. that can be complicated or it can be very simple, depending on the repertoire.
Talking about hanging, mm-hmm. I mean, these concert halls are huge. They're very, very tall inside. And you see them literally hanging from the, you know, the sky, so to speak. You know, it's like very, very long cable. And then you see, you know, a bunch of microphones hanging around. That's usually what it is. It's not usually sitting on microphone stands.
Right. I'm very particular about that. I know that there are some people who will work with a lot of microphones on stands. I think it's a bad idea for a couple of reasons. Number one, you don't really want to have the microphone coupled to the surface that the musicians are using, especially if there's any percussion involved, because that gets transmitted through the stage floor and thence to your microphone stand. And unless you have extensive shock mounting to the microphone itself, you're not just going to hear a boom from a bass drum. You're going to hear a big thump from the percussive stuff that goes just through the floor.
Because it's a wood floor.
It's a wooden floor.
Like if a kid jumped off a bunk bed and landed on the ground on the floor above you,
yeah,
that's the sound and impact that will...
Anytime anything is dropped on that stage floor, you should hear the giant boom that results, because it's designed to be resonant. You know, it's got musicians on it with instruments directly coupled to that floor. So you want that floor to reinforce the music as much as possible. The downside of that is if you stick a microphone on the deck, it's also going to be subject to those same vibrations. And that's not the music part you want to capture. Mm. That's a noise part. So you want to avoid that if you can.
So hanging is?
Hanging is preferred for that number one reason. The number two reason is people are moving around on stage. They're changing the set between pieces. They're moving chairs around and all. If you've got mics on stands there, things get knocked over sometimes. WETA does not have the budget. I mean, we've spent a great deal of money on the equipment that we're using. It is as good as any place anywhere in the world. We are very, very fortunate to have exceptionally good equipment. And the front end of that are very expensive microphones that are used to capture the orchestra. I'm very protective of them. I don't just want them sitting out there where any accident can happen. And nobody's going to intentionally do it, but things happen. So
I've seen, and that's another thing, when engineers don't properly tape cables down, I've seen musicians injured,
yes,
sometimes kind of bad.
Yes.
And also a microphone stand falls and it hits an instrument.
Yes.
That's even worse.
You can imagine how horrified I would be in any such circumstance. So it's another reason. It's basically the third reason that I don't want anything out there on stands if I can avoid it, because I don't want anything that can possibly injure a musician or damage an instrument.
Your job has a lot of extra things to take care of when it comes to not just the equipment, but the people and the instruments. So it sounds like hanging is the best thing, and that's what takes up your time on like a Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yeah, on a Tuesday afternoon.
Tuesday afternoon. And
typically. Sometimes we have to do modifications later, but it's typically on a Tuesday afternoon. And yeah, I mean, in my opinion, it's the only way to go. I know there are plenty of engineers who would disagree with everything I'm saying. It's like, oh, you're overblowing the case. Mm-hmm. You know, and that. Well, maybe. I don't care.
Yeah.
I prefer to be safe than sorry. And so that's one of the things that we do. That's not to say that microphone lines can't come untied. Every once in a while, something like that happens too. And it's happened here in performance. Rarely, very rarely.
Like where a hanging mic, something happens where the cable is...
Well, not the cable. I'm never really worried about those, because those are extremely well anchored to bricks and everything up at the ceiling. Those are not going to fail. That's not it. It's the lines that tie them into particular positions over the orchestra. Sometimes something can happen there. It happens exceptionally rarely.
So I want to just clarify that. Some people might not notice that actually. So when you're going to a concert hall, you'll see the microphone hanging, you'll see the microphone cable, and that's usually the thickest one. But then there's something very thin, almost like a fishing line to make it go out of your sight, that will then pull it to one side or the other into position. So then looking later into the week, once you've gotten these parameters set with the orchestra, with the conductor, what they want to be brought out, a soloist generally does not come on a Tuesday. They're going to arrive on a Wednesday or even sometimes later on a Thursday. When they're at the front of the stage, maybe a violinist, they're standing. Do you ever look at a video of that soloist to see how they stand? Because people move around all the time and stand differently.
I do indeed. Violinists in particular, but not just violinists. Sometimes it's a flute player or a clarinetist or somebody else who's doing a concerto. I will definitely look to see if there is video available so I can see how much they do move. And that will often determine what kind of microphone I use, therefore, to accent them. Ideally, this is where we get into recording philosophies, really. Ideally, I want a soloist to be clear at all times, not get swamped by the orchestra, but I also don't want the soloist to sound like they're on a big pedestal above and out in front of the orchestra, almost in a different acoustic space. I've heard recordings like that, both live and commercial releases, that I find really disturbing. I mean, it's almost like they were done at two separate times. It was a multi-track thing where somebody recorded the orchestra and then the soloist came in later and did their bit. I know in many cases it was a live performance and that didn't happen, but it sounds like that happened by the way it was mic'd. There may have been very good reasons why it had to be done that way. I do everything I can not to have that kind of sound. That's just not the way I like to work. But if I see a soloist on video who's coming and they move around a lot, I will definitely change the way that I will mic them so that I can keep them in the field that the microphone sees as much as possible. If there's a question about how much this person might be moving around, I might actually, for the first rehearsal, set up a couple of different arrangements and then test between them to see which one seems to be working best. One thing that is very difficult sometimes is that a really good, considerate musician, that is somebody who really has the orchestra in mind and is trying to play the best possible with them, will spend that first rehearsal turned completely around for me and actually be facing the orchestra, which is such a lovely thing to do to rehearse with the orchestra so that everybody in the orchestra can hear what's going on. They know what this person is going to be doing, and therefore they can match their performance to that. And that's just wonderful. And my stomach just sinks through the floor when this happens because it means I'm going to get nothing from this rehearsal that is really going to be helpful to me. I'm going to get one rehearsal, and that'll be the dress rehearsal, and I will just have to hope for the best that I can make that work. Sometimes I'll have a little opportunity to try an adjustment between the dress rehearsal and that Thursday performance, but there are other times when it's just not worth taking the risk. You know, what I have is usable, and chances are during the performance, they'll actually stand a little closer to the stage, so maybe it'll work out okay. So you just basically have to take your best chance with that. But some of the best musicians we've had as soloists, I'm referring to people who stand up, like a violinist or a flute player or a clarinetist or something. Some of the best ones we've had will use that Wednesday rehearsal to face the orchestra during the rehearsal, to even wander from section to section. It's like, when we're playing together, this is what I'm doing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I want you to hear it. I want you to know what my phrasing is going to be like so you can match it, that kind of thing. That is great musicianship. That is a terrible frustration for a recording engineer, but it's all about the music first. So I do not have hard feelings about anything of the kind. And the results in performance are always better. So absolutely do that. I will enjoy it as best I can and work with it as best I can, but definitely make the music first and I'll do my best to capture it.
What does it look like going into the concert? Is that when maybe not, you can't just sit back and relax, but there's less work at that point? It's all maybe for better or for worse on the table?
Yeah, that's sort of usually the easiest part for me, I guess. There's a lot of work going into the rehearsals. There's a lot of work in potential editing after the fact. The actual performance is one of the things I guess I can enjoy more, even though I am still worried about making sure that I've pushed all the right buttons and that I haven't made any blunders of my own.
Let's talk about buttons and pushing them for a second. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how you actually record. Something people might find surprising is I have never seen you with a computer or a tablet of any kind recording. We're recording right now. You're recording. I don't see like any kind of screens or anything. How are you recording? There's no computer.
It's all magic. No. That's really kind of a mirage that you say you don't see any computers around, because quite frankly, everything is a computer these days. When you visited me in past years, when I had a console, more of a console setup, and multi-track recorders and all of that, everything there was a computer. It just was disguised to look like something else. But a mixing console these days, that's of modern manufacture. A digital console, you open it up and it's all computer cards in there. You know, you don't see anything that looks like old style electronics. It's all like computers. Same with the multi-track recorders. You open those up, you see computer cards and hard drives and solid state drives and everything in there. It's all computers. Even though it doesn't look like a laptop, it's a computer. Recently, we've upgraded our setup and it's a more computer-centric system. So if you came to visit me during an actual recording then, you would see a computer, you would see a screen, a keyboard, mouse, and all of that. However, as soon as I can arrange the time, I will set up a more console-like surface because it's more human-friendly to operate that way. And it allows me to have a greater control over a wider variety of things in a smaller package than trying to click around to a bunch of different screens on a computer. I can work that way, and a lot of people do work that way now because they don't want to carry around a console, but I'm pretty much installed here, so I can have a console of some type, and I generally tend to prefer working that way, although I've done plenty of gigs where it's just been a computer and a mouse and a keyboard, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So it can be done that way, and a lot of people can make great recordings that way. Whatever works best for you is great. I just like using my fingers. Mm-hmm. Although I'm old school in this regard too, and when I've taught other people how to do things, I've had students over the years, especially younger folks, one of the things I have to train them out of doing is staring at the screen trying to find where they're going to make their edit. And I've gone as far as turn the screen off and said, look, you're going to make this edit with your ears. You're not going to be looking at the screen. You're not going to be looking at a waveform. We're going to turn the screen off. You're going to listen. You're going to find it with your ears. And that's how you're going to make the edit. Now we can refine it with the screen on, but you're going to find the basic spot this way. And they're like, why? Why would you even do that? What sense does that make? Well, because this is an aural medium you're working in. You need to be able to hear what's going on. I have heard many, many broadcast recordings and commercially released recordings where it was obvious that the editing was done by eye rather than ear. Because you can hear a discontinuity or some other weird thing. An attack gets upcut a little bit because that little tiny waveform that is the part of the sound that you want.
Like a little tick.
Or a little tick, you know, but it's part of the sound. It's part of a percussion instrument, say, if you've got somebody playing a xylophone. That attack, that's crucial. And it may not be evident in the waveform, depending on what your zoom level is and how well the software draws the waveform. So you might go, oh, it's right here. That's where that note starts, and you make the cut. And then if you don't listen critically after the fact, you don't realize that you've just cut off the very beginning of that note. The tone is still there. The note itself is still there, but the attack is gone. The attack is crucial to the music. You know, you can't just let that go. So when I've seen people who were really focused on the visual aspect of the editing, then I've made them force them to use the ears instead of the eyes so that that kind of thing doesn't happen. And some of them really get it right away. They're like, oh, of course. I see what's going on. Yeah, I understand. I just wasn't even aware I was doing that. And other people just refuse. They have to have, they're visually oriented and they have to have that visual representation or they just can't do it. I'm very lucky in that when I first started in the business, there was no digital stuff. Everything was analog tape and I was using a razor blade. And you had to rock and roll to find your position. And then you had to very carefully mark that position and very carefully overlap things. And you had to be really meticulous about making the edit. And then if you messed it up, it was a big deal to have to try to fix it. So you always wanted to get it right the first time. Well, that technique and that desire to get it right the first time has saved me a great deal of time over the years. And I'm very happy that I had that kind of experience early on. And I wish more of the, quote, kids nowadays would have that same kind of experience too, so that they could be more connected to the audio part of it, the aural part of it, versus a visual representation on a screen.
And actually, two big points on what you just said. the whole rock and roll and the razor, 99.9% of people don't know what that is, but I'm going to put a video on the show notes page at classicalbreakdown.org of a video demonstration of this, because that's something I've actually never seen in person or done myself, but I've seen this engineer teacher, I just Googled and I found it, and every year he brings it out to show his class and how it's done. And I'll put a video because it's very fascinating. But before that, you were talking about editing with your ears, not your eyes. That's the number one biggest thing I ever heard and learned from you. And also Deb Lamberton, my predecessor, that has taken me through everything.
Yeah, it really makes a big difference. I can't emphasize enough how important it is.
Classical Breakdown, your guide to classical music, is made possible by WETA Classical. Join us for the music and insightful commentary anytime, day or night. You can stream the music online at WETAClassical.org or through the WETA Classical app. It's free in the App Store. So, you've mentioned picture and image and some things like that when describing a recording or the sound we're getting. What's happening there?
Oh, it's a big question, actually. My personal philosophy is that the orchestra should sound like a homogeneous entity because they're playing together as an ensemble. But the recording should be clear enough that when you want to focus on some individual thing that's happening in there, you can do so. For example, the entire orchestra might be playing some piece, but the second clarinet has some little contrapuntal thing going on. I want to be able to hear that clearly, make sure that it's there because the composer wrote it for a reason, and it usually has some crucial part of the whole. I want to make sure that all the crucial parts are evident, but I don't want them to be so evident that they draw attention to themselves, that you go, whoa, you know, that second clarinet's loud. You don't want any of that. You just want to have the picture in front of you. How can I compare it? Say there's a landscape, either a photograph or a landscape painting in front of you, and you're standing in front of it, and you see the big picture, and you generally get an impression from that. But at the same time, there's something happening right here underneath this waterfall. What is that? And you can go up to it, and you can look, and there's enough clarity in either the photograph or in the painting that you can look and see, what do you know? There's somebody there standing underneath the waterfall, which you don't see from a distance, from 5 or 6 feet away, but when you get your nose up to it, you can see it. Ideally, I would love to be able to make a recording like that, where you get a big picture of the orchestra and the ensemble and how the piece sounds as an aggregate. But there's enough clarity, enough detail underlying all of that, that if you want to listen carefully, if you want to focus your mind, your ears on something that's happening within the orchestra, you can still pick that out. It's very difficult to do. It's very easy to go one way or the other. It's very easy to have just a big kind of amorphous blob of sound. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, that's the whole orchestra. It's all there, but I've lost the detail. And then it's way too easy to go the other way, where you have a whole bunch of microphones out there and you're mixing them together in individual pieces, and it starts to sound like a hodgepodge, almost like a pointillistic painting, that no matter how far back you stand from it, it's never going to coalesce into a whole. It's always going to sound like individuals. It's a difficult thing. It's a matter of individual taste, and not everybody agrees. And it's very tricky to get something that everybody's going to agree on is that's a good representation. And within a given week, I might have people from the orchestra listen and say, oh, that sounds great. That's really terrific. You know, nice job, and pat me on the back. It feels great. And then 10 minutes later, geez, that's really not any good. You know, we really need to have this and have this and have this. And what do? Well, you try to make the best compromises you have, but you have to recognize that everyone's different and everyone's hearing things a little differently. And some people within the orchestra want to hear things as though they're sitting in the orchestra. And then other people in the orchestra want to make sure that their part doesn't sound like you're sitting right next to them, but that it's part of the ensemble. And it's really fascinating. I mean, you get me started on this subject, I could really go on and on. But when I first started doing this job, there were a lot of people in the orchestra who were even of an older generation then. So they grew up and they started playing in orchestras during the 1950s, maybe even early 1960s. And the philosophy of classical orchestra recording then was very much to have this homogeneous whole. And so whenever they would see me putting a microphone anywhere other than 10 feet up and 5 feet back in front of the orchestra, they would flip out a little bit, thinking that this is not going to be a good recording. You know, we're not a pop ensemble. We're not a jazz ensemble. We're an orchestra. You got to make sure you get an orchestra sound. I did understand that, and I took great pains to make sure that I was achieving that kind of picture. And eventually I gained a lot of those people's trust, and they stopped worrying when they would see me put up a microphone somewhere that they thought was weird. And now, nowadays, the younger members of the orchestra are kind of the opposite of that. They actually want a closer, tighter, more studio sound. Mm. And yeah, they want everybody to be able to be heard, but they kind of want everybody to be able to be heard from the same perspective. So it almost robs the orchestral image of any depth, because everybody sounds as though they're recorded, you know, 3 feet from a microphone. Mm-hmm. An orchestra is a big entity.
Yeah.
It's big laterally. It's big in depth. There's a substantial distance from the front of the stage to the back.
Yes.
And if you really want to make what I consider a good recording, you need to maintain that wide picture and that deep picture. You want that three-dimensional sound. You don't want everybody to sound like they're the same distance from everybody else. There's a reason the orchestra is laid out the way it is, mm-hmm. and it behooves a good recording engineer to make sure that that kind of image, that kind of depth, that kind of texture is preserved. So it's a real challenge. It's a challenge to do it technically, and it's a challenge to make everybody happy when you think you've achieved what is the right balance, and then some people will agree and some people won't. And you just have to make the best compromise you can.
I love the picture, landscape picture analogy, because that really, I think, puts it together. I'll hear recordings that are newer and use a lot of microphones, you can tell. And it sounds like the landscape picture, things are a little distorted. Like if you went up to look at the person by the waterfall, why are they 16 feet tall? Or why is the sun, you know, over here? It's things sound a little distorted in a way versus some older recordings I love from like the 1950s or 1960, where it's two microphones in a high school auditorium and it sounds incredible.
Yeah. Ding, ding, ding. You win the prize right there, because you've nailed exactly one of the things that bothers me a great deal in some modern recordings. Mm-hmm. Not all.
Yeah.
You know, once again, every engineer, every producer is different. They have their own ideas about how things should be done. But like you, I am very bothered by recordings that are obviously made with a whole bunch of different mics mixed in what I would not consider the proper proportions, or perhaps not even distanced properly.
Yeah, it's always unfortunate when I see a recording and I'm like, oh, I can't wait to hear this from this group, and you put it in. It's like, oh, it's the musicians sound fantastic. But yeah, it feels a little funhouse mirror a little bit.
Funhouse mirror. That's a very good description. That or I think I heard you once refer to them as like a jigsaw puzzle that's sort of misassembled.
Yes. And this is a problem that is really perfect for classical music, because this is acoustic music, and you know, our ears and brains are quite smart. So when you hear, you know, a violin pluck a note in a concert hall, your ears and brain know exactly what that decay naturally sounds like.
Yeah.
So when anything's done in like processing to alter that, it sticks out right away. It grabs your attention because it's an unexpected sound.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So you've worked through all of these questions, problems, things to go through throughout the week to get the concert recorded. It was great, or all three concerts, rather, through a series. Now, what happens afterwards when it comes to actually editing this music for a release, either something we play on air, like on NSO Showcase every month, or for a CD? Because this is very different than a band going into a studio to record a rock band, they may have 25, 30 takes of just one single vocal line that they can then choose to do whatever they want with. You've got one concert a day. The temperature might be 5 degrees off, maybe in a hall that doesn't have the right control. That can change the pitch. Maybe the tempo is slightly different. Maybe someone's starting to get a cold on the last day, and so they're having their sound is a little bit different. How do you possibly edit that together compared to a rock band that might be playing with a metronome where you can just almost build it from scratch?
Really good, tough question.
Yeah,
the circumstances that vary between performances can really be challenging, to say the least. And they're all the ones you mentioned and more. The actual environment does change. The temperature and the humidity of the room does change, and it changes the character of the sound. And you may not even notice it recording from one night to the next, but when you go to put performances from different nights together, you realize suddenly, oh my goodness, that's really quite different. Mm-hmm. And what are we going to do about that? Well, you do what you can. Sometimes you can equalize the signal a little bit. That is more sophisticated version of a tone control where you can boost certain frequencies to try to match them from night to night. Or in some cases, you may have to reduce those frequencies. The worst case scenario really is when we have Thursday night performance, the orchestra is off on Friday, and then we have a Saturday night performance. We only have the two, and the tempi are wildly different between the two performances. That happens. You know, the Thursday night, say there's a lot of feeling, a lot of rubato, and it's just a very organic kind of feeling. Saturday night's highly caffeinated for some reason. You know, it's just the tempo is really significantly faster.
What makes live music so exciting is also a, not a negative, but it's something you have to then deal with after the fact.
Right. Yeah. I generally don't consider it a negative because, as you say, it's exciting. It's what's great about live performance, right? But when you have to try to take something from this night and match it with something from another night for ultimate broadcast or, as you say, commercial release, then it can be very, very challenging indeed. And I had to do one of these within the past year where it wasn't so much that the orchestra was faster, but we had a soloist with great musical sensitivity and adventurousness. So the performances were radically different, Thursday night to Saturday. Radically different in general tempo, radically different in the implementation of rubato, radically different in pedaling. This was a pianist. Nothing was the same. Nothing. So for somebody like me who got to sit through both performances, it was fantastic because I got to hear two very different, very exciting in their own way performances, and it was glorious. But I knew that when it came time to actually editing it, it was going to be a problem, and it was. And what I eventually had to do was take the bulk of one of the performances and just patch the little things that really had to be patched from the other night. And they were generally not even performance things. They were audience noise problems. Or in one case, we actually had, it was a piece of equipment. I don't even remember what it was, but it was a piece of equipment on the stage or just backstage that made a noise a couple of times at very inconvenient spots where the soloist was playing alone and softly, and you could hear this because he was playing alone and softly. So it was a matter of patching as best I could, and in some cases I had to make him play it a certain way in order to make a bridge from here to here. Because when he actually played it one night, it would have been fine, but it was obscured by this noise, and it never would have been allowed to be broadcast. Somebody would have objected, and we wouldn't have been able to use it. But I needed to get from this part of one night's performance to this other part of another night's performance. And the detour I had to take, I kind of had to clear my own path. I had to edit it in such a way that he played it in a particular way in order for me to get from here to there. I hate doing that. I don't want to do anything that's going to alter what an artist is trying to communicate. That's anathema to me. I absolutely hate that. But in order to save this performance for a broadcast, I was required to do it. And I was lucky enough to have the tools at my disposal to be able to pull it off. such that I don't think anybody would notice except for the artist himself, and that's only if he remembered exactly what he did. And generally speaking, the reason they're so different from night to night is they don't want to be robots. They don't want to play it exactly right. The same. And so they will often put out of their minds how it went the other night, except in broad terms. They will say, you know, well, I remembered that was kind of fast and maybe it was a little too fast, so I'm going to play it slower tonight. That's often the extent of how it goes. Some of them are micromanagers and they know exactly what they did and they know exactly what they want to do differently. But when I've spoken to some of them about this, most of them have said they aren't micromanaging like that. They just know they had a certain feel one night and they feel differently tonight, so it's going to go differently. In his particular case, though, the performances were so different. It was like two different people almost. But as I say, for me, having the privilege of attending and hearing both performances, it was wonderful, just glorious. It was just tough to edit.
It is almost like magic in a way, because I hear your recordings and I have to work with your recordings for our monthly show. And these are things, all these things that you're talking about, that all of the work and that you're doing, this and that, basically you're creating a recording when I hear them where you almost don't exist. You know, I don't have to think about nothing. You don't think about anything. You just have the music coming. And it's kind of like when you're a musician, when you're playing something, and I hear someone play, for example, are they asking me or are they telling me? You know, are they playing confidently in a way that the message is received, or is it they or maybe they're unsure, therefore they're going to play unsure. So I think the same with recording, there's a way where you disappear and the music is just there.
John, that is the highest compliment you could possibly pay to me.
Really?
Absolutely. This goes back to a question you asked me some time ago, some years ago, actually. You asked me my opinion about what made a good recording. You know, what makes a good recording? You know, we need to talk about that sometime, you said. Well, here we are, of course. The answer to that, the basic answer I can give you is that you know it's a good recording when you put it in and you're not immediately conscious of the recording. What you are aware of is the music and what it's communicating. If you are immediately aware of the technique that's used to record or the patchwork way it's assembled as you've described it, then you can begin to call that a bad recording, I think. Absolutely the highest compliment you could possibly have paid me is to say that when you listen to one of those, you're not even aware of what I'm doing. It's just the music that you're hearing. That is incredibly gratifying to me. I can't thank you enough for saying that. And I think it's probably the goal of just about any engineer and producer out there, that's what they're going for. Sometimes they may have impediments that keep them from achieving it. I don't mean personal impediments. I mean, they may have other people in the process who are dictating changes that they may not want to make, and the finished product isn't what they had in mind, doesn't match their vision. But I think they probably all share the same goal, and it's exhilarating anytime we can actually reach it. There's a recording I did not long ago with the NSO of Bruckner 6 that... It was a magical week. The audience was practically silent throughout the entire performances, and they were really into it. They weren't just disinterested falling asleep. They were on the edges of their seats, and they were so into it, they weren't even breathing, it seemed like. It was so amazing. And the orchestra was in top form. They were actually playing it better than anybody I'd ever heard play it before. You know, one night was really good, and then the next night was just as good, and the next night was just as good. So it became a dream to assemble that into an actual performance. And I had some professional acquaintances who happened to be in town, and they attended the, I think it was the Friday performance, the middle performance. And they came to see me after it was over, saying that that was the best Bruckner 6 they had ever heard. And I'm like, really? Because you guys have been in the business. You've recorded this with, you know, these famous orchestras. Well, yes, it was the best that they had heard. That spoke a lot to how well the NSO was doing. And then they said, how's the recording coming out? And I said, well, okay, I think. And let's hear it. So I had to grab the headphones and, you know, play some of it back for them. And fortunately, they said, oh, the recording's just as good as the performance. Oh, this is fantastic. You've got to convince them to release this commercially. Well, I laughed because that's rarely in the cards. Not that it's never happened, but it's rarely in the cards. But I said, well, we'll see how the other performances go and, you know, how it all gets assembled. It was one of those rare occasions when I got to the end of the process, I kind of sat back and said, I don't know how I could have done any better. This is the best that I'm capable of doing. And I've been very, very happy whenever I've listened to it again. Sometimes, you know, time goes by and you listen to it again and you think, oh, well, okay, I was a little too enthusiastic before. Every time I listen to it, I get a little bit more enthusiastic. It's one of the very rare circumstances where everything just seemed to come together.
I listened to the recording, the whole thing, and it's exactly everything you just said. The second movement,
Wasn't that just phenomenal?
Unbelievable.
I swear it is the best rendition of that I've ever heard anywhere. And I have listened to all the extant recordings that I could get my hands on of this piece. It's just indescribably beautiful. Absolutely fantastic. Wow. I mean, this orchestra, they just outdid themselves on that piece. It's incredible. It's incredible.
And we're kind of walking down this little path of just almost distracted talking about this recording. And that's the point of music in these recordings. They will just grab you and they can change you. And it's just almost, I don't want to say life altering, but when you have headphones on to really get a great sound of the recording as opposed to listening on your phone speaker, it is an experience.
Yeah, it really is. And that recording in particular, when people do listen to it, I hope they get a chance to listen on really, really high caliber equipment of some kind or other, because the full range of audio frequencies that an orchestra can produce are there. And it is a nice, expansive soundstage. And I would just love to be able to share it with everybody. I wish I could just send it off now to, you know, everybody who might be interested in hearing it, because it's really great.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic performance. One of the best the NSO has ever done in the entire time that I've been doing this. And that's been almost 3 decades now.
Well, fingers crossed, and we'll keep everyone up to date, you know, as to when that will be airing. So just before that, we were talking about editing recordings and how that is with classical music, all the challenges you described, and how when I listen to your recordings when I'm working with them, and how you disappear and it's just the music. And I'm glad you like that, because it's great to build you up, because now we can tear you back down. Because just to share about music engineers, if people haven't grasped already, you're very, very particular.
Mm-hmm.
The more particular, peace and love, almost annoying that an engineer is, that's good. That makes, in my mind, that's what it takes, that level of attention to detail to achieve all this.
I can't disagree in any way. It takes a tremendous attention to detail, to the point that you can really irritate other people. And I have, and I'm sure I continue to do so. But as you say, that's what it takes to get the job done sometimes. And I do my best to be as cooperative and easygoing as possible. And I think I generally achieve that, but
mm-hmm. Like yesterday, one of our last texts were about a WAV file that I've already converted to an MP3 for something else for streaming. It's already done, but no, I need to send it to you again, because you need your version, which is the better version. I'll do that every day.
Well, I'll tell you what that's about. And again, this is highly technical and probably people nobody would care, so they can fast forward through this section. But the streaming limitations that we have require our sound files to be sourced from specific tools about doing that, so that we can minimize the artifacts that are required.
And when it comes to representing anybody who wants
to stream the show with the best material we can possibly provide, I want them to have the best experience that we can give them.
Well, thank you for proving my point on engineers. And also, I mean, one less task I can do. I'll take that any day.
Well, I'm happy to do it, because I know that I'm able to use the best software possible to get this accomplished. So, yes, just engineers being engineers, they are who they are, and I don't think you're going to change them.
So engineers have a certain way about them, but what are some things that audiences or just people do that might annoy engineers?
Oh, that's easy.
Yes, maybe.
Just cough on the downbeat. I don't understand it, but it happens so routinely that it cannot be an accident. Seriously, it happens a lot.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you, I guarantee that it's going to happen at least one concert of the three in any given week. And I guarantee you that it's going to be the first edit I have to make to prepare something for broadcast or any other usage. Guaranteed. Guaranteed.
So some things to maybe help with that are, if you have cough drops, unwrap them beforehand.
Long beforehand, okay?
Long before.
Don't do that on the downbeat either.
Oh, yeah. Do that before the music starts, before the concert, so you have it, you can have a cough drop.
Right.
That might help.
Yes. I have been to concerts with people who, you might say, took that to an extreme. They had their cough drops. They unwrapped them in advance and lined them up, like 1, 2, 3, 4, on the armrest or something, so that they were always available. They just had to reach over and slip one in. They didn't have to do anything else. We engineers love people like that. You're more than welcome to do that. I would be very grateful. But please don't cough on the downbeat. Just don't.
Just don't.
If you have to do that, make sure you do it during the applause when everybody is acknowledging the arrival of the conductor or the soloist or the concertmaster, when Nurit Bar-Joseph comes out to tune the orchestra. Do it then. Not loudly, because they need to hear their A to tune, okay? Don't be obnoxious about it. But do it when there's applause going on, when it'll be well covered. Not when the house has gone quiet, everybody's anticipating the moment. The maestro raises his arm, lowers it, and don't do that.
Well, we've had a couple years of coughing, I think. But cell phones as well.
Cell phones. That's obviously a pet peeve, but it's much more so since the end of COVID, because the printed program has gone away. Mm-hmm. So if you want to read the program, you need to do that on your phone. And they encourage you to do that. And I encourage people to do that too. But when you have the phone open to read the program, please press that Do Not Disturb button while you have it on and it's, you know, ready to be used, because that will help prevent the worst case scenario that we often get, where in the softest, most poignant moment of a wonderful Mahler symphony that everybody's just holding their breath, and then Do Not Disturb. That's the setting you're looking for. Do Not Disturb. You can still read the program. You can still, you know, do that kind of thing, but you will prevent that kind of catastrophe from happening. Everyone will thank you.
So even for engineers, what is the most inconsequential cough or vibration or ring from your phone or something? And you go on with your day, but for Charles, it's a lasting... Yeah. Frustration.
I have to confess my affinity with the audience in this regard, though, because they're buying a ticket to a performance. Mm-hmm. They're not buying a ticket to a recording session.
Exactly.
So they expect to be able to behave as somebody would in a performance. And that's what I expect, too. But there are some things that, even if you're not worried about it being recorded, you still don't want to do. And coughing on the downbeat, that's one of them. Having your phone go off, that's another one.
Cough on the upbeat.
Just don't cough.
Let's talk about the importance of recording. There's a historical aspect to this, even a social aspect of preserving what is happening, you know, right now in this time and place. One, because of, well, things socially that happen, but also stylistically, we can hear recordings from 5, 6 decades ago and hear very different ways of playing. Different styles of vibrato is one that I think people can easily pick up on. So there is a kind of importance or even sacred nature to recording. How do you feel about that?
Here's where the historian in me comes out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I studied history at college more than I probably should have, but it's a fascination with me, and I adore historical subjects. Recording preserves the events of our culture. That's the best way I can put it, I think. And it creates these snapshots in time that allow things that occur now, the great things that occur now, the great performances or the great historical events, get preserved and transmitted to future generations so that they can experience them along with us in some way. It may not be the exact way you would in the concert hall. That technology doesn't yet exist. I have a feeling it'll get there, but right now we don't quite have that technology. But that's what it does. It basically captures a snapshot in time the capabilities of people at a given time and allows them to be preserved and enjoyed by generation after generation after generation. Basically, when I think of what musicians have to go through to get to the point in the career where they're playing in a major symphony orchestra like the National Symphony Orchestra, the years of study, the countless hours of practice that all culminate in, like especially in that Bruckner 6 we were talking about, an absolutely fantastic, transcendent performance. And if it's not recorded, it evaporates into the air and it's gone. Everything that that giant collaboration represents is just gone. I hate that.
Yeah.
Just the thought of that gives me the shivers, that all that is just gone. Yes, it's enjoyed by the people in the house for that period of time, and then it's just gone. Some people will say, well, that's part of the magic of it. You know, you exist at a moment in time. You're hearing this occur at a moment in time, and it's happening for you and the people who are immediately around you, and then it's gone, and that's it. That's the magic of it. Sure, I can understand that. But we have the capability now to preserve moments like that so that other people, currently via our broadcasts or via commercial release, or generations hence, somebody who runs across it, can listen to it and enjoy it and appreciate it and dig into it, study it, really get a feeling for it, and know how capable people were at this moment in time when this was done. I just think that's incredibly valuable. And recording technology of all kinds, whether it be audio or film or video or any of that, I think it's just one of the best things human beings have ever done. Mm-hmm. And I hope it just keeps improving and we keep documenting more events and more events and more events forever. I think it's crucially important.
So what would be like a most gratifying aspect or maybe even concert or recording of this for all of you? Maybe it's the Bruckner 6 or maybe it's the idea of preserving this.
I'd say the most gratifying thing is just preserving it, just being there to be able to document this and make it available to anyone. Even things that aren't eventually broadcast, they're still in the archives. Mm-hmm. And somebody who wants to go through and mine the archives to either study a particular conductor, a particular soloist, or whatever, that information is here. They can do it. So that's gratifying to me to know that no matter what happens, the material is still here. It still exists. It's still available for some purpose, even if it's just some kind of historical research. But it's especially gratifying when something turns out really well and somebody like you says that it's so good that I'm not even aware of how it was done. I'm just overwhelmed by the music. I cannot emphasize enough how big a compliment that is. And whenever I occasionally do something here at the NSO and a number of the people that I have to please. I mean, I have a lot of people to please. I have about 100 musicians on stage. I have a music director. I have soloists. I have administrative staff that I all sort of have to please. And it's really gratifying when in the process, I'm able to do as best as I possibly can. The product turns out what I think is pretty well. And then somebody in that collection that I just mentioned happens to agree and will tell me so. That's very gratifying too, because you feel like what you are doing does have some meaning and people do appreciate it. Because very frequently, especially in the broadcast realm, the radio station realm, we're broadcasting, we're sending stuff out, but we don't get immediate feedback on what we're doing. We don't know that there's anybody out there really listening and enjoying what we're doing until maybe we get a note sometime. Mm-hmm. Same with this.
Wow. So what would then be maybe a crazy situation, maybe something you can laugh about now in retrospect, and maybe not something about coughing or the cell phones. I'm wondering, has there been just a wild situation you've been in recording where you almost can't believe this is happening? I mean, things happen, and I'm sure you've...
Well, for good and bad. I mean, I've been involved in performances like this Bruckner 6 that were so great. I can't believe this is going so well. And that's marvelous. I love that.
You've never forgotten to hit record.
I've never missed a concert because of that.
Mm-hmm.
I take that back. I've never not recorded the concert. Have I ever forgotten to hit the record button? Yes. Well, not exactly that. What it was...
And I'm just going to note that he looked over at our recorder.
Well, I always want to make sure that it's still operating, and it is. No, I've never actually missed a recording because I forgot to hit record or something like that. But some of our older equipment got finicky, and some of the buttons didn't respond right away when I pushed them. On one occasion that I can recall in particular, I went through and I started all the recorders at the time, and one of them, which was a hard drive-based recorder, for whatever reason, just decided it wasn't going to work that night. And I pressed record, and everything was fine, and I went from the equipment room where it was living into the room where I was mixing and started up the other backup recorders that I have going, the two-channel mix that I do on site to have as a safety, just in case. And after a little while, I just got up to stretch my legs a bit and went back to the other room just to check on things and noticed that the multi-track recorder was not running. Why? I don't know, but it was just blinking like a Christmas tree and nothing was working. Okay, well, mild panic set in, so I went back to the other recorder to make sure that it was, in fact, recording, and it was, and then I just sat down very quietly and didn't touch anything because I didn't want to cause any additional problems. So the material that we used that night was just the two-channel mix. And fortunately, this wasn't the first night. This was the intermediate night, or maybe the last night. I think it was the intermediate night, actually. And I had already pretty much dialed in the mix, so I wasn't going to change much after the fact. So it worked out okay. But there is abject panic that hits you sometimes when something like that happens. And fortunately, I had a different audio chain going that, you know, was able to record the concert, so we didn't lose anything. But I was worried for a moment that if anything happens to this other recorder, you know, that's it. That was panic-inducing.
Well, we've talked about so much here, uncovering some of the magic that goes into what you do. I'm fascinated by it, and I read about it, and I watch videos online about sometimes about sound and everything. It's beyond confusing, it seems, and I think you've uncovered some of the magic here in showing really what goes into making a recording, and not just making a good one, but making one where you yourself get to kind of fade into the background.
Well, I have to say, as difficult as the job can be, it is also tremendously fun and satisfying when it all works out. And I have had the fantastic experience of meeting a huge variety of marvelous musicians over the years. I cannot possibly count them all. And some of whom I've become kind of friendly with, and that's always nice. But the fact that I've met so many historical figures, I mean, there's no other way to describe it. They are historical figures, and to have met with them and worked with them and documented what they do, yeah, it's tremendously gratifying. It's a job that I'm very glad I've had, and there aren't many occasions when I would trade it for anything else.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Classical Breakdown, your guide to classical music. For more information on this episode, visit the show notes page at classicalbreakdown.org. You can send me comments and episode ideas to classicalbreakdown@weta.org. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave a review in your podcast app. I'm John Banther. Thanks for listening to Classical Breakdown from WETA Classical.